And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I want to thank all of you who responded to a request for feedback, and the question had to do with how you can keep me engaged. We want to know, and still do, what kinds of things would be helpful to you and keep you coming back to read or to listen to what we have to offer. It's a tall order to keep somebody listening to, in many, many cases, the same information somehow repackaged to make it meaningful to more people or to help emphasize something to people who have been around for a long time. And we don't do this because we get some sort of income for every open. We make nothing at MarketWatch, and we only have one affiliate, actually two, what they call affiliate programs, one with Amazon and one with M1, where we get a very small amount of income from people who go there and transact business. So thanks for all your feedback. I'm going to address some of those emails because along with a kind of a general statement about how we keep you engaged were some very specific questions that I think will help many of you. In fact, the first one the timing was just perfect because out of this response came this question. I am in my late 70s and don't have 30 or 40 years to wait for the returns you talk about. What do you have for those of us who have fewer years to live and are trying to figure out what kind of returns we will likely get from our portfolios? And part of this question, I know, has to do with something that is commonly mentioned, and that is we spend too much time talking about people who have many years till retirement. They haven't even started taking distributions. And as I have tried to defend the way that we educate people, we try to present information that could help both groups. But I must admit, when we're sitting around talking about 40 years of performance, that doesn't necessarily mean very much to somebody who is in the last 20 years or 10 years of their life. At age 77, believe me, I understand that feeling. But as good fortune would have it, an absolutely perfect, well, it's not exactly perfect. It doesn't address our portfolios, but it's close enough to give you a feeling of what that challenge is in trying to figure out when you don't have the so-called long term, what can you expect? And of course, we're talking about probabilities. It has to be about probabilities because it is not an exact science that we can tell you what will happen in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years. We will have a link in the notes to this podcast, to this article written by one of the folks that we consider to be a truth teller. And we've talked to Larry Swedrow and Don and Tom from Talking Real Money and a lot of the folks whose work that we've referred to. We think these are people who are telling the story that we believe is really in your self-interest, your best interest, not theirs. In this case, it is Craig Israelson, who writes often for the AAII Journal. He teaches as an executive in residence in the Personal Financial Planning Program at Utah Valley University in Orem, Utah. And if you followed his work, you know he is the one who developed the 7-12 portfolio, which has a lot of similarities with our 10-fund ultimate buy and hold strategy. But in this particular article, it is a discussion of exactly what this gentleman was asking about. And the title is, How Long is a Long Run? Because we often talk about the long run, the long term. Well, at 77 or whatever age, people in their 70s and the 80s, certainly they can't be planning for 40 years. So what do we know about the returns over shorter periods of time? Well, the study that Craig has put together is probably as good as any I've seen in giving perspective to this question. So here's what he has done. And I'm sorry for the numbers. I'll try to make them easy, and I think you'll get the idea here pretty quickly. He looked at four major U.S. asset classes: U.S. large cap stocks, U.S. small cap stocks, U.S. bonds, and U.S. cash. And in the case of the bonds, he was using intermediate term governments. And in the case of cash, he used 90-day T-bills. Now, when we normally refer to T-bills, we're talking about 30-day T-bills, which are going to pay a little less than the 90. So the number you're going to hear here in a second is going to be a little different than you hear from us. So first he had to decide what the long term was going to be. I normally think of the long term as the rest of a person's life. But for the purpose of a specific study, he had to pin it down. And he pinned it down, looking back over 95 years of data, starting in 1926. And by the way, we normally start in 1928, but then we're able to pick up the small cap value and the large cap value. But going back to 26, you can only get the S&P 500 and small cap equity for equity returns. And the assumption was, by the way, that the portfolio, when he did build a portfolio, and he will here in a second, it was rebalanced annually. It did not include any taxes. And he took the returns out to the hundreds. So when he looks back over the last 95 years, the S&P 500 compounded at 10.29. The small stock index, 11.31. Well, let's just note there's something important, and that is that difference between the large cap and the small cap, and that premium was almost the same 1% that we talk about generally. The bonds averaged 5.3%, and the U.S. cash, remember that was the 90-day T-bills, 3.35. But then he built a portfolio that would probably be similar to a lot of people who might be in the latter part of their lifetime investing strategy. And he built it with 40% large cap, S&P 500, 20% small cap, 30% in bonds, and 10% in cash. Now, and again, it's not really cash. There is some interest in those T-bills. And what is interesting here is with the annual rebalancing with what is basically a 60-40 strategy, 60 equity, 40% fixed income, the average annualized return was 9.08. And just for the interest of it, note that the intermediate bonds were 5.3. They made more than half of the 60-40 portfolio. Not bad when you consider there's almost no risk, but we'll see how not bad it is. And then the 90 days were the 3.35%, about a third of the return of the 60-40. But when you put $100 to work over that 95-year period, the value at the end of 95 years is about $1.1 million for large cap blend, about $385,000 for the 60-40. In other words, that 1% lower return cut the total return. Now, that's a lot of years of compounding, but down to $385,000. Then get this, the intermediate bond, which made more than half of what the 60-40 made, was $13,500. And if you look at the value of $100 over 95 years at 3.35, it's about $2,300. This is why I don't beg, but I certainly do grovel a lot trying to get young people to understand that over the long term, that difference in the so-called guaranteed return and the risky return actually makes the more risky return look a lot less risky than the more safe return over the long term. And I just realized I forgot to give you the compound return over the 95 years for the small cap index. This is not small cap value, it's small cap blend, and that would be $2.6 million. So you start out with no risk and you end up with $2,300. You take a little bit of risk in the fixed income on a short-term basis because those intermediate bonds go up and down a very little amount, but it goes from $2,300 to $13,500. Then it goes to $385,000 by going to a 60-40, 60 equity, 40 fixed income, then up to almost $1.1 million by going to 10.29 in the large cap blend. But the home run is small cap blend, 11.31, $100 compounding over 95 years to $2.6 million. And I'm just hearing the comment now being for the person who is in their 70s saying, what does it matter what the 95-year return was? It is the next 10 years or 20 years that I'm concerned about. So Craig takes a look at the returns over 7 different periods, and he compares the ability of the different asset classes and the 4 asset portfolio to, in fact, reach that 95-year return. In the case of the U.S. large stocks, that return was 10.29%. So looking over the period, he looked at 61 35-year periods, and in 84% of those periods, that 10.29% was achieved. Now, that's not perfect, but that's a very high probability of success. But it took 35 years to get that kind of success. If you go to the other end of the 7 periods, the 5-year periods, it was 57% of the time you made the 10.29%. When you went out to 10 years, it was 48% of the 86 10-year periods that you made at least 10.29. When you got out to 15 years or 81 periods, it actually only goes up to 51. So you're worse off in terms of hitting that long-term return at 15 years than you were at 5. But then when you go out to 20, it's 55%. 25, it's 52%. By the time you go out 30 years, there's a historically 70% probability that you're going to get that 95-year return. And the same thing is generally true of the other equity holdings. For example, and I'll just give you a couple. You might remember that it was 57% of the time that the large cap stocks were able to get that 10.29%. Now, the small stocks, you recall, they made more. Let's see. Now, they made 11.31. And in 56% of the five-year periods, the small caps did make the 11.31. At 25 years, the large cap had, in 52% of the years, made that the bogey, the average or the compound rate of return for the whole 95. But with the small companies, 70% of the 25-year periods made it, and 71 of the 30-year periods, and 79 of the 35-year periods. But the key is there was about a 50% increase in the percentage of longer-term periods that were able to meet that 95-year return. What is interesting about the bonds and cash is that over the five-year period, only 42% of the cases were they able to make the 95-year compound rate of return. And by the time you go out to 35 years, it was only in 59% with bonds and 66% with cash, which means not only did you get a lower rate of return with bonds and cash in terms of the what they call the nominal return, as opposed to the inflation-adjusted return, which would be called the real return, but they not only made less money, but they were less dependable in terms of meeting those lower rate of returns. But the thing that people worry about is that when you don't make those long-term returns, how badly do they underperform? Well, there's some good news and there's some bad news in that area, because in the case of the 35-year periods, when there was underperformance, the underperformance was only on average about a half of 1%. Now, as we know from those earlier numbers compounded, a half a percent's a big deal. But that isn't such a big deal that somebody would be panicked about underperforming by a large amount. On the other hand, when we look at the shorter periods of time, like if we look at the five-year periods of the underperformance of the portfolio, when it failed to achieve the long-term return, remember it was 9.08 for the 60% equity, 40% fixed income, it underperformed on average by about 4.5% a year. And by the time you get out to 10 years, it's about 2.5% a year. By the time you get out to 20 years, it's about 1.5% a year. So when you're within that last 20 years, particularly within 5 years, If you don't hit the average, you are likely to suffer, probability-wise, a significant underperformance, which is exactly the thing that people are concerned about. So I can see why this would concern some older people. But there's another side to this story, and that is that younger people who go into the market and they think they're going to make a lot of money in those early years, there is a fairly high probability that, one, they are not going to even achieve the long-term results of that particular asset class or combination of asset classes. But to the extent that you don't meet that long-term return, you are also likely to suffer much lower returns than that grand expectation. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is, and it isn't in this study, but I know intuitively, that means that you are investing in asset classes that are not rewarding you today, and in fact, it's during the period of time that you don't have much money at risk that you're underperforming, and it's during that period of time that that money coming in is going to be picking up these cheaper shares. So it turns out to be okay for the early investor, except the early investor who doesn't have the patience to see the performance come out in the long term. Dr. Israelson's conclusion is, so just how long is the long run? Based on these findings for stock and stock-based portfolios, a long-run investment period is at least 25 to 30 years in length. Translation, young to middle-aged investors might want to plant a hardwood tree the same year they start investing. And when the oak tree is about 35 to 40 feet tall, which should take roughly 25 to 30 years, the portfolio will very likely have achieved a long-run return. And now I want to try to move a little faster through a whole bunch of questions that came in again, in response to the topic of how you can keep me engaged. And one question came in here from a member of the Bogleheads from the East Coast, and he says, between you and Larry Swedrow, you've got me convinced on adding a sliver of small value to my own portfolio. It's too bad many retirement plans either don't offer that option or they have high expenses. Do you have a hard cutoff on what level expense ratio is acceptable? Well, it is an interesting challenge because expenses are a serious consideration. Remember that there is the expectation that small cap value is going to give a premium of 2 to 5% compounded over time. So if you have a mutual fund that's actively managed and has an expense ratio, let's say of 1.2, which is the average expense ratio for small cap value funds, and you could have had access to a fund that is like a Vanguard index fund that is less than 0.2, there'd be about a 1% higher fee with that other fund. You're also going to have more expenses in that other fund from trading, if it's an actively managed fund. Although, believe it or not, I have seen S&P 500 funds, index funds, a full 1% more expensive than a Vanguard fund because they have built in an extra fee so that the employee, the person whose 401k plan is being invested for them is paying the fees of that particular plan by being charged an extra fee. Now, if it's a very small plan, it may actually be cheaper. But if it's a normal plan and it's building up in tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands and then hopefully millions, they are getting one whale of an expense for managing that plan. And in fact, there are cases where you should look carefully to see if you would be better off, instead of putting that money into the S&P 500 within that retirement plan, to do it outside, inside of an IRA, maybe even a spouse's IRA, because that lower cost would be huge over the long run. And of course, with active management, we also don't know, and those are the ones that typically are the more expensive funds, we don't know if they're going to hit their target return, whether they're going to get that premium, because many of those funds are going to produce much lower returns. That's the nature of active management. Some people higher, some people lower. And you can see the return variation. I have seen, for example, the Hartford Small Cap Value come up in plans, and it's had some good times, but it's also had a lot of bad times. For example, I looked at the Small Cap Value VIOV at Vanguard, that has a similar size company as the Hartford Small Cap Value. But when you look at the performance of the Vanguard fund, it was twice over the last 9 years, it was twice in the bottom half, but the other seven times, it was in the top 25%. Whereas in the Hartford, it was six out of the nine times, it was in the lowest 50%, and once was in the top 25%. So we're looking for consistency from an index fund. It may be that index, that asset class, doesn't do well for a while, in which case maybe there would be another small cap value fund that did better because it wasn't really a pure small cap value fund. Those things happen. And the third question came from David. He says, Paul mentioned his occasional recommendations about his favorite Vanguard funds in a very popular lecture. Well, the lecture itself, by the way, I think I made it to about 10 people. And then we put it on YouTube, and we've now had about 83,000 views. But David goes on. He mentioned the Wellington and Wellesley funds. These are obviously actively managed funds, albeit with excellent records. And Paul has spoken and written repeatedly and strongly against actively managed funds and for index funds. So why weren't the index funds of similar construction and performance, especially the balanced index fund? And he gives several examples, but his first one is the VBIAX. It's a balanced fund that is about 60% equities and about 40% fixed income. And that fund has a fee of 0.9%. And the Wellington fund is 0.17, I believe. Trying to remember these numbers, but there's about it's less than 0.1% difference. but he still wants to know, why would I recommend Wellington, for example? Well, typically when I've recommended these one fund for life kinds of strategies, I've used a fund that not only has a fine track record, and Wellington does, but that's been around for a long time. And I'm looking for something that these people who are typically not real do-it-yourselfers, they just happen to want to try to get out of the fee. And I'm hoping that because Wellington is so large and so successful for a very long period of time, it will give them a sense of security. And it's with Vanguard, another sense of security. By the way, the turnover, I was surprised to see this at Vanguard, that the turnover at the balanced index is actually just a little bit more than the turnover with the Wellington fund. So as somebody once said, that the best investment you can make is one that you'll stay with for the long term, even though it might not be the most profitable on paper. The reality is that the longer you're able to stay with something, the more likely that you're going to get the premium. At least that's the history of asset class investing. Number four, I've answered this one in the past, but I think it's an important one. The question is pretty simple. They looked at our recommendations for bonds and noticed that our recommendations are a combination of, this is in the tax-deferred area, short-term governments, intermediate-term governments, and TIPS. And they want to know, why not just use the Vanguard total bond market fund and TIPS? Well, it's a fine point. The difference isn't going to be huge. Maybe it'd be a little simpler just to use two funds. But there really are major differences. For example, the Vanguard, the total bond fund, is partially in triple Bs. So those certainly aren't governments. And they have about 46% in governments, compared to the ones that we recommend are all governments. Now, if you look just at this year, you would notice that that total bond market ETF, or the fund, is down about 1.8%. Now, you compare that to the short-term government, which is down 0.1%. On the other hand, the intermediate is down 1.9%, which, the longer the maturity, as interest rates are nudging upwards, the more price pressure they're going to be under. And the TIPS are up about 2.2%. So the strategy is meant to be very low risk during rising interest rate environment. If you looked during this same period this year, just year to date, at the long-term treasury fund at Vanguard, you'd be down about 7%. And that's the reason we don't use the long-term bonds, because we are not looking for the most profitable bond. We are looking for the bonds that are likely to stabilize the very best. And the Vanguard Total Bond Market Fund is not going to be as stable as the short to intermediate slash TIPS of an all-government portfolio. So what the academics taught us when we were going through the work at the training at DFA back in the mid-90s is that if you want to get more aggressive than short to intermediate bonds and move into corporates, even high yields, that you're probably, you don't know, but you're probably better off in the long run to simply add more equities to the portfolio. Yes, you'll take a little more risk, which you would take by adding long-term bonds to your portfolio or adding the total bond market to your portfolio. You'd be taking more risk. And the academic said you're likely to get a better unit of return for the additional risk if you simply increase the percentage that you have in equities. Here is a question that comes from a listener who has been following our work since before we started writing at MarketWatch. So that's a lot of years. Recently, he says, I've been listening to quite a few of your podcasts when taking daily walks and have told my friends to give your podcasts a listen as well. One of my friends wrote me back today to say he likes your podcast too. He's becoming a regular listener. You and your colleagues are providing a real service. And now on to Andrew's question. And I'm going to paraphrase it. He wants to know, what advice or evidence do we have to show somebody to help them determine whether they really are behind in what they need to have for their retirement? And also to protect them from becoming and having a sense of desperation that they don't have enough and seeing the market having made such great returns that they are going to be caught up at the top of a bull market with too much inequities and end up coming out behind. That's the best I can do, but I understand that. Now, what do we have? What could we say and show people that would help them get through this? Do I have enough? Will I have enough? If I don't make it now, will I have a chance to make it in the market in the future? I mean, there's a whole bunch of emotions that go through our minds when we are in a feeling of even mild panic about financial situations. Well, the reality is that it's hard to give advice, and it's hard to offer evidence, as any piece of advice or evidence is not likely to fit the specifics of that individual situation. This is why I think working with an advisor, where there's an opportunity to spend hours with people, getting to know that person, getting to know, there's so many things. Why are they so behind if they are? I mean, it may be that if you looked carefully at their situation, you'd find out with a little more saving and without taking too much risk, they'd be just fine. But it may be they've been through this whole thing before. When you sit down and talk to people about their history with investing, they might have gotten tagged in 2000 through 2002. They might have gotten tagged in 2008. I mean, there's so many possibilities in the past that they could have done the wrong thing at the wrong time, and the question is why? And so when we show them tables of numbers and we show them of returns and combinations of portfolios and taking money out, all those, the evidence that we have does not necessarily address the kinds of things that are driving the decision making. What's the health of the parties? What's the likelihood of the longevity? What's the lifestyle that they want to live? Maybe what they need to do is to adjust their expectations for what retirement should look like. What are the possibilities you're going to need to help children or parents? And how much flexibility do you have in terms of being able to continue working? Are you attached to your present home to the point that even if you could sell it and capture some of that cash, that would be a great way to catch up rather than taking more risk in the stock market? There's a picture there that takes time to develop. And this is why I can't do what needs to be done except to prepare these tables and the fine-tuning tables that I think most of you are aware of, and the accumulation tables that we've done, and the distribution tables that we've done, so that you can help somebody see how much they have to have. I mean, there's all these variables that are in those tables, but on their own, the kinds of people who panic and go through this fear of missing out or the fear of losing money, I mean, all these fears, those tables typically don't do the work that it takes to protect people from those emotions. I've often thought that if I really wanted to get this work to where it needs to end up, that what I need to do is to find a group of advisors around the country. And it wouldn't even necessarily be that they had to believe in the way that we prescribe investors put together a portfolio. But if somebody came to them and they understand what we believe in, and the person who's coming to that advisor knows our work, that they could then work together and work through all of those personal issues and then put that together with the tables that Chris and Daryl put together. They're doing amazing work in helping us understand the impact of all of these historical numbers. And it's even going to get better in the coming months as we are able to add calculators that will make these tables dance and live in real time with different amounts of money, both in the accumulation and in the distributions. That all can be done. But the struggle with people who get into the fear of missing out or the fear of losing money, boy, that is more than those tables. That is somebody to be there to do some hand-holding when they get that rush of anxiety and fear. And here's the reality for our work. We know it can be life-changing. Sometimes people do complain that we spend, as I mentioned earlier, more time trying to help young people than old people. But that's not where the money is. You know, Dellinger robbed the banks because that was where the money was, okay? Well, we're not teaching because that's where the money is. We're teaching because that's where the money isn't. And we know that this information can be life-changing. I'm scheduled to spend 3 hours with a group of recent Western graduates in July. And during that 3 hours, I'm going to walk them through the $12 million decisions, the two funds for life, how to get the most out of their 401k, the amazing possibilities of a Roth, and why they need to stay away from the lures of Wall Street. And I will show them how one very small decision should add $5 to $10 million over their working lifetime. Let's remember, they're just getting started. What's inflation going to be like? What's the cost of living going to be like? It's going to be a lot more than likely than it is now. But I also know that as hard as I'm going to work in that conversation, that maybe 10% of the students or graduates are going to do anything about it. And it even gets more difficult once people are at feeling high anxiety about who they are and what they're going to need and will I have enough. Boy, those are huge concerns, and we understand that. And I'll say it one more time. I think almost everybody who is getting close to retirement, maybe within 5 years, 10 years, Sit down with a professional to review what your plan is. And if you don't have a plan, sit down with a professional to have them put one together on an hourly basis, including your spouse, who you may think is not interested in the process of investing, and that's not surprising, but I can tell you they are interested in the outcome of the process of investing. I really like this last question of the day. In fact, I may even try to get Don and Tom to take this on as a question that we do when we get the three of us together. Eric says, a few months ago, I came across your writings. I'm very impressed with your insights about beginning long-term investment at an early age. I am at the other end of life's spectrum. He's 80. Because of risk aversion, I have maintained my funds in savings accounts and CDs during my entire life. Because of rising inflation, I am now prepared for the first time in my life to cautiously invest in the market. I note that you no longer maintain equity positions and have most of your assets in bond funds. What steps would you recommend for me to take a conservative approach to bond or target funds so that I can continue to enjoy my retirement? Well, first of all, Eric, it is an honor to give advice to somebody as to how to invest in the stock market when they have decided to be a CD investor all of their life. I am not an all CD investor, nor an all bond investor. My wife and I, and I'm 77, and she's just a few years younger, we are 50-50 stocks and bonds. So taking out 5% a year, in theory, we've got 10 years worth of income just from the bond part of the portfolio on it, just that part of it. But we do invest on a total return basis. We rebalance not just the different equity parts of the portfolio, but we also rebalance the equity and the bond portions of the portfolio. So they move around depending on whether stocks are going up or down or bonds are going up or down. But it is an interesting challenge at 80 to decide you're going to take some risk you've never taken before. Now, I don't know whether you have way more money than you need or not, but I appreciate your concern about inflation. And certainly, at 80 years of age, you have lived through a period of very high inflation. So I've got a couple of ideas that I think are baby steps that are worth considering. And by the way, I have no idea what your health is like, but we just spent a weekend with a couple, and he's 88, and he hiked as fast as I did, and in our fun debates we had, he stood his own. So I would guess he's one of these people that's going to live to be over 100 unless something catastrophic happens. But, and that may be your situation as well. So you could have 20 plus years. But here are some ideas. One is you could be a better shopper of CDs. I don't know how hard you shop, but I know you can oftentimes find better returns. Certainly you can check out bankrate.com. They've got returns all over the country, and that's one way to improve your return. Second is You could, and I know, by the way, that CD rates right now, you can find them from 0.25% to 0.85%. But I also know that you can get these multi-year guaranteed annuities that are really kind of a hybrid of a fixed annuity and a CD. And those rates are higher than CDs. Now, what you would want to do is, if you did this, is you'd want to be sure and compare. Maybe you're getting some special rates that I'm all wet and you can do just as well. But I know right now that when you look at the list of the top five three-year multi-year guaranteed annuities, MYGA, that the average of those top five are about 2.2%. Now, that's not a home run, but if you're sitting in CDs at a half of 1% or 0.75%, you are tripling your return, maybe. And you can ladder them. I mean, you'll get higher rates as you go out further. Some are going to pay over 3% a year. So you can create a ladder. Now, you have the same problem as you might with CDs. You want to get out early, it's going to cost you. And it's going to cost you more in these annuities than it's going to cost you with a CD at the bank. But if you know what your needs are, and that must be a consideration you give when you decide what maturity of CDs you're going to buy. So that is certainly one thing that you could do. I would recommend, if you're going to do that, to visit stantheannuityman.com. StanTheAnnuityMan.com. He has got hundreds of videos. He's got books that are free. And if you ask him for the books, he will not call you. You want to talk to him after you get the books or after you watch the video? You call or you email and you get an appointment. And Stan will talk to you. Not somebody else, Stan. And he is an expert in this arena and shops all of the major markets. Not everybody shops all of the major markets. Now, this is not all that he does, but this is something that he does as well as anybody else. In fact, because he shops so many markets, and by the way, you want high-quality insurance companies, and that's what Stan works with. And I do not get compensated by Stan. I just know his work and his commitment to education. Now, you could also, now we've moved you up from, let's call it 1% to 2 or 3%. You could also invest in something like the Vanguard Life Strategy Income Fund. And it's mostly income. It's mostly bonds, 80% bonds, 20% in stocks. And you may not remember exactly the rates that you've gotten with CDs over the last 15 years, but I can tell you in the Vanguard Life Strategy Income Fund, the compound rate of return over 15 years as of yesterday was a little over 5%. But there was one bad year. There was one minor setback in 2018 of 1.95. And in 2008, the year that stock markets collapsed and some bond markets collapsed, they were down 10.6%. So you wouldn't want to do that By the way, it came roaring back the next year. You wouldn't want to do that with money that you're going to need in the next few years. So as you look at your portfolio, you could plan that for use in 5 or 10 years. And by the way, the further out we go, the more the investments tend to be for people who survive you, which means these are the kinds of investments that people should be in who are going to survive you. In fact, if you absolutely knew that 40% of the portfolio you would never need, Vanguard has a fund that is a conservative fund, but it's 40% in equities. And that 40% over the next 20 years, if that's how long you live, would be growing for them, not for you. And of course, you may, like a lot of people who have tried this, not be able to take it, even if it's just a small part of your portfolio. I have seen people who, even having as little as 10% of their money in equities, being emotionally too much risk, even though they could afford it. I love the fact that you asked, Eric. I mean it. And I would really like to know what you do. Maybe you'll take a little money and shop the CDs. Maybe you'll take a little money and you'll do a MIGA and pick up a few percentage points there with a very high-rated insurance company. Maybe you'll take a piece of it and put it into the Vanguard Life Strategy Income Fund. Diversify. I wouldn't put it in something that isn't totally liquid. There's no reason to take any undue risk. I hope that helps, Eric. And by the way, do me a favor. I'm guessing at age 80, you have younger people in your family who might appreciate you sending them the free PDF for the recent book that came out end of last year. It's called We're Talking Millions, 12 Simple Ways to Supercharge Your Retirement. And I promise I'm working hard to make sure they don't end up in all CDs for the rest of their life. And by the way, it sounds like you did okay putting your money in CDs. You are probably one of those folks that are a fantastic saver and just not a great risk taker, in which case you did just fine. I hope that helps. All the best to you. And to the rest of you, if you know somebody you think would like to get a copy of that book, the free PDF, along with the notes from this podcast, we'll have a link to that free copy. And thank you for listening. It is an honor. It's an honor to work for all these young people, and it's an honor to work for the older people as well. Good luck.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.